Now it's time for Open Journal's Community Spotlight here on KPFT Houston.
Thoughtful gifts, children's laughter, and tender words conveyed by beloved characters in Miracle on 34th Street and It's a Wonderful Life take many of us back into a world that is long forgotten. It isn't a time to think about bad things, and if we do, they certainly won't appear as very magical. Most of us see magic as producing good things. However, magic can also help us endure things that are a little scary or at least uncertain. Just ask the Irish about their stories, the ones we would rarely label as enchanting. They don't seem to suffer much from the interference that modern ways can have when it comes to traditional folktales. This morning, we're going to support that claim by tackling a seemingly unenchanting topic, death, by exploring the Irish take on death through folklore. Good morning, and I hope all of you had a beautiful Thanksgiving, and welcome to Storytime on KPFT's Open Journal. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubichek, Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Houston downtown. You know, the Irish are among the very best at telling mystical stories about death, with their intriguing characters, each urgently symbolic of death. And my guest, Maxine Lennon, tells them best. She's been on Storytime before and got rave reviews, and you'll soon find out why. Natural and fluid are used to describe Maxine's style by those who fill one of her favorite performing venues, A Path of Tea on West Alabama, as well as those who retain her to entertain at events and receptions citywide. A skilled voiceover talent and storytelling coach for Steel Confetti Enterprises, she listens to what you want your message to say and then says it artfully and convincingly. Her audio documentaries record the stories and voices of everyday lives and make every life she records extraordinary. She's a member of the Houston Storytellers Guild and a true maestro of human expression, in my judgment. Maxine, good morning.
Good morning, Hank.
And it is wonderful to have you back here. I just love having you here, and I love talking to you, and it's just a lot of fun. You know, the Irish still tell stories around the fire, sometimes hovering around an older family member, a matriarch and patriarch, and sometimes I understand a member of an Irish family will tell the nightmarish tale of the dreaded Banshee and how she appeared to a family member on a cold, dark night. I hope this kind of sets you up for your first story.
It certainly does, Hank, although I think the Banshee's getting a bit of a bad rap, but we can talk about that after the story.
Please.
I'll go straight into the story.
Screaming like a Banshee.
Well, now, this first story involves Avil, who's a very famous Banshee. She's slightly different from other Banshees in that she's the sister, actually, of Anya, one of the goddesses of Ireland, who is the goddess of love and sorrow and wealth and sovereignty. But Avil, her one particular story concerns a family that she's very, very fond of, the descendants of which are called the O'Briens. And most Banshees will attach themselves to Max or O'Briens. They are the oldest families of Ireland. But this story takes place in an actual date and time. It takes place in 1014, and it takes place on Good Friday. The Danes had taken Dublin, as we all know, the Vikings had invaded Ireland, and were determined to take more. But Bran Baru, the High King of Ireland at the time, decided that he was going to call all the chieftains together for a final battle, and they were going to take back Ireland, or at least, at the most, or the least, stop the Danes from taking any more. So he called his son Morrick and told him to get all the chieftains together, 60 chieftains. Now, Morrick sent out the word, but one chieftain didn't turn up, a guy called Dulang O'Hartigan. Now, Dulang was a bit of a shame to his people. They kind of looked on him because he wasn't fond of fighting. Dulang was a lover and a poet and a storyteller. And also because of that, they believed he had magical powers. So they kind of let him go with it, that he wasn't the bravest of them. But anyway, the messenger was sent to bring Dulang into battle. So the messenger arrived, and there he was, sure enough, in a drinking shebeen, listening to poetry. And the messenger said, "You've got to come to this battle. This is the biggest battle. You're demanded to come." So Dulang, shamed and did, said, "I'll follow you, boy. Away you go." So he made his way after the messenger several days later and arrived at a Calix cavern. And on the road, close to this magnificent cave, he saw rags lying in the middle of the road. And as he got closer, he thought, "But Jesus, that looks like the body of a woman." So he went over and he lifted the rag, and his hand was grabbed by a gnarly, grey, twisted arm. And this was Avil. And he knew as soon as he saw her that he was in the presence of someone very powerful. And she said, Dulang O'Hartigan, it is lucky I caught you before you went to this battle. I have a warning, and this warning you must give to Brian Boru and his family and all the chieftains. All of them will die tomorrow at the battle, including you, Dulang O'Hartigan, unless you do exactly as I tell you. And Dulang said, certainly I'll listen to you, because he knew the power of Avil. So he listened. And the Banshee said to him, I'll tell you what you have to do. At this battle, you must wear this petticoat I'm going to give you. So from underneath all these rags, she pulled this dirty, grey petticoat that rats had gnawed for centuries. And she gave it to him, still warm from her body, and told him to put it on him, and he wouldn't die in the battle. But she said, you must warn Brian. So he goes and he makes his way to the battle, and he gets to the tent of Brian Boru, and he walks in and he says, King, I have a message for you from Avil, the strongest of the Banshees. And the king immediately listens, and he says, what is it? So he told the king the warning, and the king sadly shook his head and said, I knew I heard her last night. I heard her wail in the mountains above the battleground. But no man can avoid what is ahead of him. And so he said to his son, gather the chieftains, tell them we go to battle. And he said, tell them it's death or glory. And off went Morrick to tell the chieftains. And very quietly, Brian put his head down and he said to himself, death and glory. And he repeated it, death and glory. So anyway, the next day the battle started. And Dulang O'Hartigan put the petticoat on and went into battle. And he mowed down everybody in front of him, not a scratch. That night, as he sat round the fires, he started to feel ashamed again, because he saw all the men with their wounds, terrible wounds, and simple happiness to be alive for just one more night. So in his shame, he tells his people why he was able to mow down the people and why he wasn't hurt. And the people look at him and they say, that's shameful, boy. You can't be going into battle wearing a petticoat. What would the women of Ireland say if they knew you went into a battle wearing a petticoat? So in his embarrassment, and typically of an Irishman who will listen to his friends as opposed to the women in his life, Dulang O'Hartigan takes off the petticoat and goes into battle. And sure enough, a Dane slices the legs from under him. And as he's lying there and looking at his legs, just a few feet in front of him, he realizes he should have listened to Avil. And that night, the women of the clan heard the wail of the Banshee and knew how the battle had gone. And it is said by the O'Brien clan, as I said, the descendants of Brian Boru to this day still say that she weeps up in those hills for that dreadful day in 1014, that Good Friday. And the Shannon below is as fresh as her tears. And that's Avil.
Wonderful. Now, you've told me several times that there are two sides to every Banshee or something along that line, and I'm going to want you to try to talk about that in just a minute. These Banshee stories are incredible, and I'll ask my question in a moment. I just want everybody to know that they are enjoying More Than a Descent into Darkness, an Irish take on death, with storyteller Maxine Lennon and me, Hank Rubicek, on Storytime on KPFT 90.1 Houston. So, two sides to every Banshee. But what does that mean?
Well, Banshee in itself, let's start at the very beginning. Banshee in itself means solitary fairy woman, if she likes. She's one of the few fairies. Fairies are very gregarious, but the Banshee is one of the solitary fairies. She's sometimes called the White Lady of Sorrow.
Well, Banshee means Irish fairy woman.
It does.
It? That's the direct translation.
Or it can be supernatural woman. There's all sorts of ways they look at it. In appearance, she is kind of scary in appearance, I guess. She's very tall. She has long, long white silver hair that goes right down to the ground and sometimes stretches for yards around her. She wears cobweb-like cloak that clings to her very thin body. And she shakes constantly with the cold and with grief. Her eyes are very red because she's been crying for centuries. And when she weeps, and when she calls out, it can sound to some like a shrieking and a wailing, but to others it's actually very beautiful. Mm. And these are the two sides of the Banshee. For the families that she supports,
right. It
sounds like the waves of the ocean. It rises and it falls as she forewarns of a death in the family.
So the Banshee is a messenger of death.
She is a messenger of death, yes, but she also is a messenger of warning, as she was in that last story. She will come to the families that she's attached herself to, as I said, the ancient families, and warn them in advance.
Is every Banshee assigned to a mortal family?
It is. If she has attached herself to the family, that's when she only appears. She rarely appears outside of that. She actually will come to funerals. of those that she loves and those that she hates, the enemies of her family. She
That's pretty much the way it is for everybody,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah. So when the keening, as we said, the wailing, the weeping and the wailing, and the keening of the Irish is given to them by Brigid, the goddess, she actually created keening, wailing.
But, I'm thinking about Clarence in It's a Wonderful Life, and he is the fairy that is the angel, excuse me, that's responsible for the James Stewart character, the George character. Is that the way banshees work?
Not really. I don't think you've got much chance when the banshee appears. You know, somebody's going down. You're not quite sure.
Right.
You're going down. She'll warn you of the extent of it, as in the battle, and say, you're all going to die tomorrow. So you do have a choice at that point in the warning. But 9 times out of 10, she's there to say someone's dying.
What are the other warning signs? What are the kind of warnings you get? The warning that was at Avil, that was clear.
That was a very clear warning. Mm-hmm. Well, to hear her in the night is to really go and check on your family. And also, I think whenever you think of the warning of her, I think more it's to do with battles, as I said, in the ancient times. She tends to stay with that. She doesn't really come for illness. She has no real control over illness. But when you think about a battle, it's a choice. Illness is not it's something that will take you.
How did the banshee first emerge as a symbol of death?
I guess she comes back right back to the pagan times, the times of the goddesses. As I said, Avil is particularly associated as a leader of banshees and as the person who was a sister to Anya, one of the goddesses of Ireland. Mm-hmm. So she goes back to pagan times. Mm-hmm. And a weeping and a wailing. You often hear of banshees, again associated with battle, where they're warning their enemies even. Mm-hmm. In other words, to make their enemies afraid. Mm-hmm. I mean, a banshee will actually be seen washing armor and clothes covered in blood in rivers and lakes. And Avil was so powerful at one time that she brought 25 other banshees with her to warn Richard de Clare and show him that they were washing his armor and his soldiers' clothes in their blood in a river.
Fascinating. Now, I know that the story you just shared with us is a folktale, but I know that myths, which are a little bit different from the folktales, are designed to explain the inexplicable. And you were talking about pagan times, for example. Is there something that banshees tried to explain that couldn't be explained any other way?
I doubt that they're explaining anything other than simply mortality is coming. Because then after the banshee, after the warning, then you have the other death people that move in. The other superstitions begin to move in once the death has occurred.
And many people are thinking about the cliche, screaming like a banshee, and we know what that means. Obviously, now at least they wail. Mm-hmm. But where does that come from?
That comes from, I believe, the keening, the instinct that inside the pain of a death or the pain of some loss is so great that the only sound that will come out is a shriek or a scream. And as I said, it depends on who she's calling to. Those that she loves, it'll come out actually quite beautiful as she walks through the hills surrounding the house that the death is occurring in.
But she'll sound the same, but it's perceptual in terms of how you will interpret that sound.
And often she claps. Clapping also accompanies it. Clapping is a warning, and sometimes, rather than the shriek being heard in the distance, once the shriek and the wailing has calmed down, you'll hear her clapping. And that follows you through the night.
Okay, but it is perceptual. It's how we interpret
it. Very much so.
Wow. You're enjoying an Irish take on death with storyteller Maxine Lennon and your host Hank Rubicek at Open Journal Storytime on KPFT Houston. You know that someone is screaming like a banshee right now, Maxine, while they're waiting in some line on this Black Friday, creating mayhem in somebody's life. Now, let's go from banshee to a bookbinder story, and this is still another Irish take on death. How did a bookbinder become associated with death?
Well, this is one that I actually put together myself, and it's like, for
this
me,
is yours originally.
It
you
is.
Wrote this one.
I wrote this one, and I wrote it in gratitude to a friend who is a bookbinder, who made a very beautiful book cover for us, an old book that we did. And when I looked at it, I thought it kind of fitted in so well with everything I've ever known about the weaving of lives and the weaving of stories, which the Irish are very, very good at. We weave things together. And so for me, this bookbinder tale wove in the whole idea of death and being taken by the hand in
very
that
good.
Final moment.
So I want our listeners to understand, bookbinders, that the symbol of the bookbinder is yours. It doesn't have
the symbol
any
of the
kind
bookbinder
of Irish history.
Other than we would think of stories surrounding the dead, and that's how we would do it.
So there'd be weaving, how life and death are inextricably related
Correct.
To each other,
and
how we meander through these uncertain roads.
And nothing to be afraid of.
That's the part I like to hear. Tell us the story.
Okay. And those final moments when you breathe your last and your lips begin to move and no one else can hear what you say, in through the window comes the bookbinder. And as you look at him, you can see his hands, you can see his face, his little glasses on the end of his nose, but his whole figure is covered in the stars and the planets of the universe and the alphabets of the world. And as he approaches the bed, he sits down by the side of your bed very calmly, and he puts his ear to your mouth, and he hears your story. All the ins and outs, all the roundabouts, all the beautiful colors, all the darkness. And by your bed is a set of pages, very beautiful woven linen pages. And as you tell your story, each story begins to fill each page. And the pages begin to fly in the air with the colors, dark and golden, beautiful colors, and then fall down again on a pile beside the bookbinder. And gradually, as you come towards the end of your story, the bookbinder lifts all those pages, and with a very beautiful golden needle and silken thread, he begins to sew those pages together. And then he covers them with a beautiful cover, either leather or satin or silk. And then he puts his hand to his ear, and you smile as you hear in the distance a child giggling. And you look at the bookbinder and you question him, what is that child? And the bookbinder leans down and he whispers in your ear, that child is the next soul and your book, your story, will be its guide. And at that point, you smile in sublime happiness. And as your soul leaves your body, the bookbinder takes your hand. And through the window, you go off into the distance at peace.
That is so beautiful, and I'm sure that you noticed I was writing things down, and whenever I write things down, I'm mesmerized. That's the cause and effect relationship. I'm never writing things down when I'm bored. I have to be fascinated. It doesn't mean when I'm not writing down I'm bored. It just simply means that when I'm writing, it's a really good sign. I needed for you to know that. The reason I love the story, I just wanted to talk about the concept of a story first and why I love it so much. Good stories start with conflict. Good stories start with tension. You know, the Once Upon a Time thing is nice if it's a children's fairy tale. But you started with that conflict. You know, the final moments when you take your last breath is when the bookbinder appears.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you started,
mm-hmm.
basically. And I love that because it really does set us up for a real understanding of the protagonist, of what the bookbinder is, and why he is no one to be afraid of, or she is no one or nothing to be afraid of. Do we have an image of the bookbinder? What does the bookbinder look like? Do we have an image in your own mind?
Well, for me, as
your character.
Yes, for me in that story, I see him very much as the person who actually I know. I see him as very much having a beautiful, almost like a little, I suppose the nearest is a little elfin face with lovely little gold-rimmed glasses. A very beautiful, calm, peaceful face. And his body, as I said, is not a body in a sense that but it's all the universe and the world combined and all the alphabets of the world, almost like you've seen the plans of pieces up on the wall,
yes.
Almost like that, all those alphabets, all those numbers, everything combined in his body. And you can see his hands, and his hands are beautiful,
yeah.
And delicate, and hands that can work,
yeah.
And I
yeah.
think, yes, that's for me, that's who he is. But it can be for anyone. I know, as an oral storyteller, when I tell a story, I give that story away.
Yeah.
So it's for everyone else to take on their bookbinder.
But I truly love that story. You know, you're talking about the fact that he's by your side. The pages of one's life are filled.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's time, he shuts the book,
mm-hmm.
symbolically, right, metaphorically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
We have the book of your life, and it is validated. It is packaged beautifully. It's systematically put together, almost like a jewel.
Mm-hmm.
It's wrapped. It's peaceful. And when the book is done, so is your life.
Mm-hmm.
But not really, because obviously the soul
mm-hmm.
is immortal.
Yes, and your book goes to guide another soul who's coming fresh into this world. It's their guide.
And that's really what it is, isn't it? I mean,
mm-hmm.
our stories, our lives are the things that we share with
mm-hmm.
others.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things that define us,
mm-hmm.
I think, more than anything else.
Very much so.
Yeah, and it really is a beautiful, beautiful thought. And I thought about that several times. through other stories, especially fables and folk tales, English and Irish, but not to inflate your head too much, but that is a beautiful story.
I think you
ought to write it down, which I'm sure you did, and get that thing published because it is beautiful, truly, truly, truly beautiful.
So in
the Irish folktale sense of the word, death really isn't a mere descension into darkness. It isn't a descension into darkness.
No.
It really isn't dark at all.
No, and there can be many. It can be dark, but there can be many changes to it. For instance, like, we believe that butterflies are the souls of the dead and the departed. So a butterfly close to a corpse is a very beautiful thing to happen. And we leave the window, this is part of in the bookbinder story, we leave a window open for 2 hours between the coffin and the outdoors so the soul can leave gently. We try to make it as gentle as possible. Now with children, we have to be careful in how we do it, because after Christianity came into Ireland, there was evil spirits. Before that and during that time, and though we still believe in it, the fairies were there also, who can capture souls too. So there's various things we do to protect the child's soul, so that it was able to leave. And also there's a beautiful story as part of our folklore that we believe those who have been swept by the fairies before and have grown in fairyland and have decided that they'd like to return, and the fairies have granted them permission to return to mortal times in order to die. They actually become sick children who die quietly. So a grandmother can become a sick child and die quietly. So therefore there's a beautiful side to trying to make that grief acceptable. A story, that's the magic of stories, as you know, Hank. It will make situations and feelings acceptable, and we learn to live with them and we understand better. Better for a mother to believe that her child has gone with the fairies, or someone has returned from the fairies, than to actually have allowed them to go. It's an unfathomable question that stories will try to answer or make easier.
Yeah, and they do really answer so many complex questions. Mm-hmm. I'm Hank Rubicek with teller Maxine Lennon, engaging us with folk tales about the Irish take on death. And speaking about engaging, learn more about telling your own story. Yeah, you've got them. You really do, especially around the holidays, by attending the Houston Storytellers Guild Story Swap held at St. Andrew's House at 18th and Heights Boulevard, the third Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. And check out our website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for story happenings and events. Maxine, when you see an image in a story, you talk about an elf, right?
Mm-hmm.
Elves are good, leprechauns are not. Isn't that what you once said?
Well, leprechauns can be a bit more devilish, and also, as I said to you before, they are the one shoemakers, so they're kind of, they've captured the whole business of making shoes for the fairies. And the fairies, gotcha, if they capture you and you dance all your life,
right,
those who do return often are missing toes because they've danced so hard.
So both in their own inimitable way has a soul.
Of course.
A sort. Yeah, a
yes,
soul.
Of
there
course.
You go. Maxine, I knew this would go fast. I knew it would. Thank you so much for your spirit and skill and friendship. And find out more about Maxine at, tell us your website,
www.ladyvoiceover.com.
Thank you. And tune in to the next story, Tom, on December 28th. In the meantime, shop safely. Have a wonderful weekend, the merriest Christmas, the happiest of Hanukkah, and the constant reminder that it is truly never too late to live happily ever after. Thank you.
You have been listening to Open Journal, KPFT's experiment in community-inspired radio. Since 1970, KPFT has been a unique source on the Houston airwaves. We rely on listener donations. Visit kpft.org to support this station. KPFT listener members are welcome to produce an Open Journal. Prospective producers must fill out an Open Journal request form, which is available at our website with details. The program director welcomes your feedback on every Open Journal. Listener feedback